Welcome to the fifth installment of the Polycast Side Series Evergreen. I'm Wouter Lecute Snijders. Made up of 28 episodes and 3 specials, the show's fifth season marked a shift from pre-recording to live recording of episodes. As with the previous 4 Evergreens, Polycast regular co-host Daniel ThenQ Quick selected and ranked the 10 topics he feels most retain their relevance years after they were first published. Similarly, recurring guest co-host Canis Albinus re-listened to the entire season to select 10 most representative moments of the show. Polycast Season 5 was also the beginning of post-produced episodes running 60 minutes in length, as compared to 45 minutes that had been followed since Season 2. The longer runtimes may or may not have been better, but they sure were different. Just like the rest of the show. Let the countdown commence. Number 10, from episode 134. A more serious matter is the foundation for the show's next generation of phone tag folly.
We were hoping to have Imran on this episode.
Were we?
And it was...
Well, you know, fingers crossed. Maybe.
Yes, we could have tag team trolled the world.
It's also a reason why we have Wouter back on here, and also why we have Michael Lucas-Smith on here. I think we mentioned a few weeks ago that October 2011 marks 5 years since Polycast became publicly known that it existed, as well as our first episode, which was released, in fact, October 20th, 2006, specifically. When we launched then, the original co-hosts were myself, Locutus, Mackey, and Imran. And as for Michael being here, until today, it's been for more than a year, Michael has been tied with one other individual for the most guest appearances on this show, but not anymore, because this is now Michael's 7th appearance on the show, and he was also, as another tie-in, he was our quote-unquote sound engineer for episode 100, which is the first time we did a live show, and now this year we switched to a live format. Now, I told my fellow panelists that there was going to be a surprise associated with this topic, and one of that has to do with, well, what we used to call the mailbag, and we now call open mic. People actually occasionally write to us, and most of it is positive. And people also respond forum threads, and most of that is positive. But whether it's positive or negative, most of it is on topic. In our first season...
Oh, I think I know what we're going to be doing now.
I wonder who might have picked up on what's going on here.
It's going to be off topic, Mike.
Yes.
Jeez.
We had a couple of wrong numbers to the show. You can listen to them back in episode 9 and episode 19.
Those were great.
What happened, actually, 1 week ago today, you know, I checked the Polycast account, first off, to make sure, you know, that it still existed. But there was a voicemail, and I thought, well, we've had a couple of wrong numbers, and there was no message. And so people probably realized, if they actually got to the end of my 20-second introduction to on our voicemail line, oh, this isn't the person that I actually want. Well, that actually didn't happen in this case. There was actually a message. So I was expecting a question, a comment, you know, a love letter, a poem, something. And instead, listeners, this is what I was greeted with. Now, it is edited to protect the, I was going to say guilty, but that's, you know, they haven't been through a court of law. So to protect the stunned, I have bleeped out certain points.
Hello, this is Jennifer calling, and this message is from in reference to the vehicle you have rented on 17th of September. According to our vacant, this due for return on 17th of October. I'm unable to extend the contract. Please return to the closest Avis location to extend the contract. If you have any questions, please contact me. See, my extension is When calling, please use the dental agreement number, which is... Thank you for choosing. Have a nice day.
Has to be automated, that's... right? Has to be.
Yeah. The...
I was like, wait
has to be.
I'm dialing a number and reading off a script and not caring what the message I just got was. As if you were actually listening to Dan's voicemail intro thing, you know you were not reaching a person per se.
It has to be an automated call. It's just the only thing that would allow me to have any faith in humanity at all. And believe me, that's pretty difficult after playing Mafia.
So I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, okay, you know what? I'll do this person a courtesy. Maybe it's towards the end of their shift. They're a little loopy. You know, they're tired. Or perhaps they actually just wanted to troll us. I don't know. Maybe the person actually listens to the show and wanted to see how we would respond. Because, you know, it's not the circumstances in life that define you, but how you respond to them. So I thought, okay, I'm going to phone you back. So
this should be good.
Oh, dear.
Keep in mind, listeners, it's how you respond to them. You heard them first.
Dan's response, troll them back.
Dan has been taught how to troll.
Yes.
If you know your party's extension, please dial it now. Otherwise, please leave your name, number, and brief message, and an agent will get back in touch with you.
Your call is being answered by extension. Is not available. To leave a message, wait for the tone. When finished recording, press pound for more options. Record at the tone.
So I was like, no, I'm not going to leave a message because I actually want to talk to a person. I also thought, maybe I don't need to leave a message. Maybe they will realize the error, right? And it was just one person. 2 days later, I checked the voicemail. There's this.
Hello, my name is calling in from... This message is in reference to you rented from Avis on 17th of October. Contracts are due only for a maximum of 30 days, but it's passed at this point. Can you please return to the closest location to sign a new rental agreement? If you have any questions, please call me at extension. When calling, please use the rental agreement's number that is. Thank you, Susan. Have a nice day.
So now I've got another person phoning me. And I was frustrated because I actually wanted to have a conversation with this person. And so I thought, I'll try the next day, right? Well, I went to call the next day, except there was another voicemail, which was this.
Hi, this is from... This message is in regards to the rented from... On 17th September, due back on 17th October, your rental is overdue. I request you to please go into the nearest location and extend the rental. Any further queries, call me any extension. And when calling, please use a reference. Thank you for choosing. Have a great day.
What did you rent, Dan?
I've got not one person from this company, not two people, but three people listening to our voicemail prompt about what this is.
And thinking this is a number that you should be calling to get a recovery of some rented item.
But I'm trying to figure out, if one person makes the call, would it not be in your system that so-and-so called, so that even if you're going to have another agent call, they would reference the previous conversation, that they might actually use some stronger language as well because time has gone by and your rental still hasn't been returned. So I'm not really certain how concerned you are that your rental has not yet been returned.
It has to be a government organization.
So when I call, or at least they modeled it on that maybe.
Record at the tone. Facts will be included. To make private, press 1. To make priority, press 2. To no longer include a fax, press 5. Facts will not be included. To make private, press 1. To make priority, press 2. To include a fax, press 5. If finished, press pound. No message to send. To access your mailbox, press star R. If you are finished, please hang up or press star star X. Goodbye.
You have reached an extension of the loss prevention department. I am away from my desk right now. Please leave me your name, rental agreement, or MBA number, your new date of return, and a phone number where you can be reached. I will return your call as soon as possible, or you may press 0 for the next available loss prevention agent. Thank you.
Invalid entry. For help, press star H. Record at the tone. You are recording a message. To bypass voice recording and create a fax-only message, press pound. To record, press 1. After recording, press 1 again. To replay the last few seconds, press 5. To advance a few seconds, press 6. Louder, press 4. Softer, press 7. Faster, press 9. Slower, press 8. To restart at the activity menu, press star R. To have system wait, press star W. To access the names or numbers directory, press star star N. If finished, please hang up, or to disconnect, press star star X.
I still didn't get a person, so I had to leave a voicemail. And as entertaining as it was, learning these new voices and names and extensions, I decided that this needed to come to an end. The person listening to this message might be someone that has absolutely no idea what it is that I'm talking about. It could have been any one of those three agents or somebody else.
Record at the tone.
Yes, good evening. I'm calling with regards to rental agreement number... there have been several, three specifically, voicemails, one from someone at extension... which redirects to... one from... and also one from extension... Again, with regards to this rental agreement, trying to catch the name, either a... or a... with regards to a rental agreement that two of the messages say start on September 17th and end on October 17th, whereas the first one talked about September 13th and October 13th. This is not the phone number for that individual. This is rather a voicemail message and phone number generally for a Polycast, Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast, which is a family of Civilization Computer Gaming Series podcasts at the polycast.net. I'm not certain where this telephone number was obtained, whether it was from Mr. or Mrs. If it was misquoted or recorded incorrectly, this is not the number for them. I tried phoning back a couple of times, wasn't receiving an answer at any of the extensions, trying to get a hold of the agent that was calling directly. But since we seem to be missing over a number of days here, I decided that I would just leave this message and to please not call this number again. Again, with regards to rental agreement... I did a search for you, a courtesy search on looking for a and found one at in at the phone number. I don't know if this is the person that you are looking for. Again, if I heard the name properly, but that is a potential start. And again, this is not the number for that individual. Thank you very much for your time. Hope you're able to get a hold of a Mr. and get your back. But I'm not the holder of this agreement. And in fact, I have not done business with your company in the past. The only other thing that I would say is it would be helpful to, when pressing 0, when calling your number back, to be able to be sent to the next available agent directly. I tried that and was told that it was an invalid extension. Thanks again for your time. Bye.
Just like calling tech support.
Well, see, I thought I would be polite in the message because I thought if I was a bit too aggressive, then they might actually phone me back just to, you know, actually do some trolling.
Your phone system sucks, P.S.
You're too nice.
They kept saying this name, so I went on to a White Pages directory, and I did a search for the name, and I found someone, and I told them what their address and their phone number was. And as you know, it's kind of like, rather than keep calling me, keep calling the wrong number, maybe here's a lead for actually getting a hold of the person that you want. The timing was so interesting when it's been 5 years since the show went on the air, and for this episode in particular, trying to get all the regular co-hosts back. And imagine I said, are you sure Imran didn't set this up?
Yeah, I was going to say, I could just see that, renting something, putting the Polycast number in your number.
The answer is no. And you know why? I know that Imran didn't set this up.
Because they weren't looking for him when they asked for the person.
No, because Imran isn't that smart.
Oh. Zing.
Number 9 from episode 135. The place for a national currency system in the Civilization series is considered.
Moving on, why don't I just introduce the next topic just because I can. Idea for individual currency system started by Insane Weasel. And yes, I believe your username is quite appropriate for this suggestion. But anyway, what if each ship traded not in gold, but in-game currency that varied from nation to nation? It would allow the player to print money. If they wanted, they could get a massive cash infusion. After a certain number of turns, they would have to pay it back with interest to the computer in the form of X gold per turn. If someone did not want to pay this, that would weaken their currency. A player with weak currency would have to pay more when trading or paying off city-state allies. Someone with a strong currency would be able to trade favorably with weak currency players. I think this would add a nice level of realism, but I worry it may be too complex, quote-unquote. I think Messick has it right where he says it's not so much a question of complexity, it's a question of whether or not it would make the game more fun, quote-unquote. And I must say that even if you were to go from gold to a currency system for an individual nation, it's kind of like, why would you bother doing that? Why not just keep it as gold? So I guess that's why he then suggests about SIPs being able to print money and get a massive cash infusion and get into interest. And then if you're a bad creditor, you're having difficulty paying your bills and making trades. And if you're a good creditor, it's the opposite. And I'm just thinking,
you can get foreclosed on.
Your nation has been foreclosed.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, do you guys want to lend money to in-game Greece? And don't we already actually sort of, I mean, okay, we call the unit of money we get from the other civ gold, but it could be anything. It's just a convenient name. I mean, if it was a different game, if it like it was Alpha Centauri, they called everything credits, you know, I mean, it's,
well,
I don't know. I
looking for realism.
Yeah. And what's our argument?
You got to look at, I mean, the reason if you print a lot of money, the value goes down isn't because we're failing to pay back some universal money marketeur in the world.
No, we're it's devaluing because, our own currency.
Well, our currency is backed by a resource. So really, what he's asking for, if he wants to go for a realism in cash exchange, would be to have, be able to fractionally trade your resources to other players and actually have your trades always be resource only. So that would just move away from using currency for units at all to actually having to use specific resources and go get those resources from other players. So that would mean every single time that you upgrade a club using ancient warrior to a modern swordsman, then you need to go off and get some iron from someone somewhere that actually physically has an iron resource, which we've sort of got that now, but we do that for absolutely every single unit, making it to where if the only resource you have is gold, then you trade out some of your gold for it. So would just be better to get rid of currency altogether if you wanted to go with that approach and then make it to where doing upgrades and whatever is done directly through resources. But I don't think that would be enjoyable.
But it would make the civic, global currency from the UN, not civic, vote for global currency in the UN a little bit more interesting. I mean, I don't know. Then you get into complications like, you know, what currency does everyone use? I mean, it would be fun to personalize the game a little bit, but what if differences had like different currency valuations, you know? Would it make it too much like real life? I don't know if I want to deal with it.
Well, yeah, and of course you're talking about the global currency that we found with the United Nations in Civilization IV. Even in Civ IV or in Civ V, the United Nations comes so late anyway, as we often talk about things that go on in the late game, unless you had a later game start, how much of an impact would that even really have, good or bad?
As Phil just pointed out, there is no vote for the UN in Civ 5.
Well, actually, Phil pointed it out in the chat, but I'm the one that said it out loud, so the credit really should go to me.
Oh, okay.
What are you, Bill Gates? Come on now. I know they bought Skype and all, but still. Yeah, looking at this, I don't know that it's It's almost more of an introduction of a banking system, sort of, than a true currency exchange system. By the looks, he's suggesting that everyone would start off with the same quote-unquote strength of currency. But the only way that I'm seeing that would make your currency change at all is if you fail to meet your obligations in terms of payback. But you know, it looks like you're just getting upfront gold here in exchange for having to eventually pay out more later. There's so many ways to come up with that in the game already that using this method would be one of desperation at best, I would imagine, because you could just sell luxury resources or whatever. And I don't know, it certainly doesn't fit the currency model of any real system that I'm aware of, but I don't know that it would add much to gameplay either, especially if you start talking about what Wilder was speaking about with the trading for basically every resource you need. That just gets to the level of tedious. And if there's not, strategic choice in acquiring the said resource, you're just having to go through extra clicks to get it, then no, it's not going to be fun. There needs to be some, fruitful decision making or something going on there that adds to strategy in the game, or it's worthless.
I'm already starting to think about how this actually could be abused in gameplay, specifically within Civilization V. Now I think about, hey, I see you've got lots of gold over there, and you're not using it, and we know how the AI in Civ 5 loves to just hoard gold. Hey, can you give me a loan of, like, say, your 2,000 or 3,000 gold? Okay, thanks. And then I turn around and just buy a whole bunch of units and say, ooh, I don't have to pay back my debt. There's nobody to collect anymore.
Well, he did say that you're borrowing directly from the computer, and I don't think he meant another player. I think he just meant there's some game system from which you get your cash infusion. And in that case, though, it's still massively abusable because there's lots of points in Civ where the first one to do it gets a gigantic advantage. So you would just get up to the verge of one of those, go, give me gold! Okay, now I got the advantage. Yeah, I can pay that back, sure, with interest, whatever. I'm winning.
I see. So you could tank your currency's rating against everybody else's, but if you win the game then and there, it wouldn't matter. That's like just the kind of mechanic for us. This has never gotten their AI.
Oh, look, I have all the techs for Space Race, so let's rush the entire ship. Oh, but look, my currency is worth nothing, but hey, we're off the planet.
We're military units, for that matter. That's what I'm thinking. Get to a specific military tech and like, oh, look, I have an army now. Like 3 turns after making it there.
My trading with you is going to be horrible, but we're at war, so I don't need to trade.
What's this trading you speak of?
I mean, if your currency were devalued, then presumably it would increase your your exports, and vice versa. If your currency went increased in value, then it would increase imports. I don't know.
It would, but you'd have to model an actual import-export system into the game first, because Civ 5 doesn't use foreign trade routes. So you have nothing to attach that to.
Yeah, if we were going to introduce this, it's not just a matter of, hey, let's replace gold with individual nation currency, and then even the other suggestions that he's talking about. The whole economic model needs to change in order for it to not be so open to abuse, and also, I can't believe I'm going to say this, actually give the AI a fighting chance, like some sort of system that the AI could also use meaningfully. I know we have issues with that right now, but it's kind of like we have enough issues with the systems that are already in place, and this just seems more complicated potentially for the human player. So if it's more complicated for the human player to use properly, what about the AI? Oh, dear.
Oh, trying to teach the AI to use this.
Yeah, get the AI to take some of these. A couple of these deals, you get thousands of gold.
What will happen is every time they go into debt, they will try to take out another loan, and they'll tank their economy.
Yeah, you can get so much money. It's ridiculous. Because they have to give you more, right, in the trade deal. So they have the value of their currency. So you give them a luxury resource, you get 1,000 gold every time.
I know what we should do. We can avoid this problem of having to teach the AI of doing anything if we implement this as part of a multiplayer-only Civ game. Hello, Civilization World? Yeah, we've got an idea for your economic system. Yeah?
I don't like it in multiplayer either, to be honest. Because what will happen is people will do exactly as mentioned earlier by Wilder. They'll just reach something that allows them to screw everyone else over, and if they get there first, then they win, because they'll just take out loans. Well, functionally, that's what this is. It's a loan mechanic. So there's nothing you can really do to stop them then.
Yeah, but that's realistic. Oh, wait, never mind. Oh, wait, this is gameplay. Right.
yes, gameplay. Please don't make too many mechanics where it's an instant loss for everyone else if someone gets there first. And definitely don't raise the occurrences of that. Not that a tech race is a bad thing, but still, bounce a little.
So what do we say to insane Weasel here? And if we were to try to summarize what we've said, plus for thinking about ways to make the economic system more, let's use a generic term, more interesting and engaging, but...
Minus because you could abuse the heck out of it.
Well, no, wait a minute, that could still be a plus.
Okay, if you're Phil, it's a plus, right?
Number 8 from episode 116. Civilization 4, specific as it may be, that the when, where, and how of introducing a friend to the series remain questions with no one answer.
Creature voice. No poll on this. I'm sorry, Dan. But, so he says, so I got my girlfriend to install Civ 4 on her computer, and I want to help her out playing the complex game. I have some questions about how I should help her out. Should I introduce her to this forum? Number 2, should I teach her orally or hands-on?
Oh, I read that earlier. It's like, oh my god. I think he should have said verbally. That would have...
What he was going for, orally was the right choice for what he was going for.
Okay, number 3, if I teach her hands-on, should it be on single-player or multiplayer? Thanks. All right, so I have some things to say about this thread. I think that some of the guys who play Civilization on Civ Fanatics are freaking jerks, man. Like, okay, I don't, well, not jerks, but just, this thread is getting kind of, uncomfortable for me. Although, you know, some other people did point out that it was a little bit sexist. But yeah, there's just, I think the first page is pretty much filled with, like, lewd jokes about this. And of course, I'm a fan of lewd jokes, but, I wanted to talk about this post from the perspective of somebody who's like taught a couple people to, well, more like forced a couple people to play Civ 4. I've always found that it's, you know, I feel like the point of playing Civ 4 with your significant other is to play it together. You know, I don't really see the point of, you know, having somebody play a game that you like if you're not going to do it with them. It really depends. I mean, I hope that you're a good judge of your own personality, because if you know that you're not, you know, a person that's really patient or just somebody that's not a great teacher, I wouldn't recommend doing it, because, you know, it can ruin relationships. You know, not like Warcraft or anything, but it can. And,
Risk.
Risk does it differently, Dan. It's not a time investment problem. That's something else entirely.
I think that from asking people who have taught, like, they said they have told me that it is more useful for them if I'm just sitting beside them and teaching them verbally how to play Civ, and just kind of pointing out things to do, some keys that they can take and what to pick, that sort of thing. Of course, it is possible just to teach them how to do it on the forums. But I mean, if you're playing the game for the sole purpose of, you know, you're playing together, and the only reason, you know, they're playing it is because of you, then I don't see why you couldn't, you know, just sit beside them while they play, or, you know, even play on different computers facing each other. There's no reason why Civ has to be a lonely experience.
So you're saying go for the hands-on approach? That's verbally. The way I always liked going.
Verbal. Shut up.
Obviously, like a joke thread. It's a joke thread.
No, it's not. It's not.
Well, I think it's a serious post. Even if you don't think it's a serious post, we can turn it into a serious post and just ignore the...
That's true.
I think it's actually most useful when you let the other person play by themselves. You know, don't actually like take the mouse away from them, but let them play by themselves and just kind of sit by them and tell them what to do. And, you know, pretty much every time I've done that, you know, I'll just sit there for like a half an hour or an hour, and then I'll just leave them alone and do something else. And I'll come back like 5 hours later. And, yeah, and they'll still be playing it. So I guess it works.
Yes, it's funny. That's how I sometimes if I've played something and my mom wants to try and play it, I'll sit there for the first half an hour or an hour, but then I can usually leave her alone to go about her own devices and poking around with it. Don't make a joke out of that, Phil.
No, I'm done for the moment. So I could play simultaneous turns and watch what they're doing too, and that would allow you to give input without actually interrupting gameplay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the initial kind of sit down and being beside and then leaving them to their own device. And then I think afterwards, like when he's talking about, should it be single player or multiplayer? Have it be single player. Maybe you want to show her you yourself showing the interface, showing you okay, this is where this is where that is. Get them in front of the computer. Okay, now you go here. You click on this, you click on that. So they start to get the feel of them actually doing it. And there was the comment, an on-topic comment from Xanax, that says, you teach her as much hands-off as you can. You playing the game for her will actually slow her down and that she will try to play as you instead of learning what to do, or I could say what to do for herself. Because your play style, even if you're going towards the same end victory, or you think that's the same end victory, you can go about that in different ways. And that's one of the great things about the Civilization series. So then once they're comfortable with that, go away for a while, and then as far as multiplayer goes, be it a hot seat or even actually over a network or even online, you could have multiplayer, if not a competitive match, that may be a little farther down the road, a cooperative match, which could include being on a team. And yes, no, being on a team skews certain things, but particularly in terms of, okay, so now you can see how I'm managing my cities, what it is that I'm building, where I'm settling, what my workers are doing. We talk about research priorities, where the other AIs are or is, depending upon how many you have. Start talking about, the diplomacy system and the interactions, when to go to war, are you trying to take a city, are you trying to pillage, those combination of things. And then Farm Boy, basic strategy for making someone new enjoy the game, play to them, entertain them, not you. So you make it about them, and then when they're comfortable with themselves, then reintroduce you and then start playing together. I think that's a good way to go. Whether it's a significant other, whether it's a friend or a family member.
Yeah, I think we've done something like that a couple times on Saturday, I think when we first started playing, where we would have teams and it'd be somebody who was really good, like Phil, and then somebody like me who's kind of middling. But now I can look in his cities and see what the heck he's doing. And sometimes you have to visually see it as it's going on to understand it better, as opposed to a forum post, which, going back to number one, I would not tell them to come to the forums. That's just going to be too confusing because everybody has so many different opinions. Let them get a good hold of the game.
It was an accident, Mackie. I swear. I did not make the Hermitage there.
I didn't build a Sistine Chapel to troll you. Not at all.
Oh. I was just trying to deny the AI culture win.
Yes.
One thing to say about, playing with them on multiplayer is that it may or may not be a problem. I would just say put it on the lowest timer. Give them plenty of time, because you don't want to put somebody on a blazing timer when they first start. Or alternatively, just turn off the freaking timer since there's only two of you.
Yeah, I was going to say, for a new person who's never done multiplayer before, no timer.
And, definitely, cooperative. I mean, just playing against humans for the first time would be confusing as hell. And one last thing would be, if you are, playing for the first, if you're introducing somebody to the game for the first time, I would recommend just, turning on the wonder animations and, the other animations that people who have been playing the game for a long time usually turn off. But I think it's, cooler to see the game that way, and it makes it come more alive for those people. I built the Sistine Chapel. Look at it build, that sort of thing.
Or my horses are fighting some other guys. No, go horses, go horses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's fun, and people don't mind it, since it's their first time. They're not like, oh, why is this playing again?
And you can even actually, in doing this, you can even focus on, especially in the first game, not even trying to think about that you're going to finish a game towards a particular victory condition, but you could set kind of your own, custom victory conditions. Starting off, okay, let's see, how are we going to get your city to a size 10 or something like that, or build X number of cities, or... once you get to this particular turn, you've gotten this far down the technology tree or something like that. And then once they're comfortable with that, then you could start working on a longer game, either in one sitting, or the save feature is great, right? Save, come back to it, save, come back to it. So, Creature Boy, we hope that, again, we have been helpful with some advice, and we hope that your girlfriend is still playing Civilization IV with you. And I don't know what the rest of my sentence is going to be, but yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Number 7, from episode 125. When the head of Civilization's publisher says that strategy games are not contemporary, backlash reverberates.
Christoph Hartmann, the president of 2K Studios, was asked about why they're turning XCOM into a first-person shooter instead of a tactical strategy game. And they bought the intellectual property through Atari or something. He said about it that strategy games are just not contemporary. He went on to posit something about Ray Charles and that he would be imitating Kanye West if he were still around, which seems ridiculous to me. So they are trying to, I guess, make XCOM into a game for millions of 13-year-old teenagers.
Oh, man. I'm, like, cringing externally, internally, and somewhere else entirely. This is painful.
My gosh, where do we even begin? In the thread on a Flash of Steel here, Flash of Steel is a strategy blog by Troy Goodfellow, who's been a guest a couple of times on the show. And in the comments on this in this thread, there were some really good ones. I think King Daddy had a really good introduction and a good summary when talking about Christoph Hartmann, the president of 2K Studios, saying it's quite an achievement to say profoundly stupid things on several fronts simultaneously.
Yeah, that's pretty much sums it up right there. I mean, right when one of their franchises is starting to compete with a finally and hopefully good turn-based strategy release, and Heroes of Might and Magic 6 coming up, we'll see about that, though. But if it is good, then Civ's going to have its first real competition in a long time. You're going to see this. Oh, no. And come on, there are so many first-person shooters in the market today that it's a little bit flooded. And when they're doing something like this business model-wise, you know, what are they going to do that makes XCOM compete with the Call of Duty, with the Halos, with the Gears of War, with all the shooters out there? XCOM is going to need something that would differentiate it from all that and put it ahead. And if the only thing that differentiates it is that it used to be a good turn-based strategy, that's not going to win out. Not at all.
And if that's indeed the market that they're going for, like you said, the market is already flooded with first-person shooters. So perhaps you think, okay, we're going to get some attention by the name. But if people aren't aware of the name and the history and can understand that, then you're probably not going to get them to go, hey, I should look at this because it's got the XCOM name and look a little bit more into it. So at the same time, you're trying to tap into that. And yeah, indeed, maybe we 90s gamers were not the majority anymore. Of course, he's also assuming that nobody from the 90s, or I shouldn't say nobody from the 90s, but people from the 90s don't prefer first-person shooters, and people from today prefer first-person shooters. So even if we accept that as the case, you're going to get lost in that sea of all the other first-person titles. And then for people from our generation who are interested in it, let's say, okay, we're going to try it, even though it is a first-person shooter, it's got the XCOM name on it, let's try it. But when you go out and you call us, you're essentially saying that we are has-beens, that we're not contemporary, and that we also need to move on. Wow. I realize it's just one person saying this, and I really think it's hurting the people who are trying to bring back XCOM, even if it isn't in the form that we wanted. I really don't see anything positive that came out of these comments. I mean, the Ray Charles comment was just, okay, you know, you already have your foot in your mouth, now you want it to go down your throat too? I mean, honestly, what... What are you doing?
It doesn't really make any business sense to me either. It's not like the nostalgia factor is going to really draw more fans to their title. Either they're going to make a good first-person shooter, regardless of the name, or they're not going to. And I don't predict too many people are going to be buying the game just because it's called XCOM.
No, especially since it isn't what made XCOM a good game in the first place.
It's not at all. It's just going to have, like, whatever slightly nostalgic references, but that won't do anything for me personally.
Imagine's right in the chat that, yes, I mean, it is one person, but it is president of 2K Studios. So it's not even one of those situations where you have someone who's like an underling, and then the person above can come and say, actually, what that person meant to say was... Really, I mean, I guess somebody lower down could say that at the peril of their own career, or at least with, you know, their continued employment with the company. I like Anders' comment on the Flash of Steel blog. I was furious when I first saw the first-person shooter trailer, but then I realized it was titled XCOM and not X-COM. Sure, it's a subtle difference, but I'll take it. Well, that's looking at the... Good for you, finding the positive.
Yes. I'm very impressed with this guy's glass half full capability.
But just to bring one point out a little further from Josh, saying that it's a shame to see industry moguls foster a disconnect between the mainstream audience and enthusiasts for the medium. After all, both groups enjoy accessibility, but it should not jeopardize the quality of the core elements of the game. And as Magin was also pointing in the thread, we 90s gamers probably have access to a little bit more money than those from the 2000s. That's not to say that there aren't exceptions. I think you can appeal to both gamers. I mean, some people suggested, how come you can't release XCOM first-person shooter and then also do XCOM, you know, and more in the strategy style that we're familiar with, that it wouldn't necessarily, you know, dilute the brand if they're, you know, under two different genres. I don't know if the fact that you've dropped the hyphen in XCOM is enough just as kind of a visual glance to distinguish. Some people actually harp on, well, does XCOM really have, you know, is it really a franchise? Is there really that much history to it? Because nothing's been done with it for more than a decade. And if you only want to appeal to one market, okay, you want to appeal to today's generation, you think that's where the money's going to be. I realize this is a business that's all well and good. Let's assume for the moment that you make it through the flood, that you ride that wave, and God, I'm butchering this analogy, but I'm just going to go with it anyway, that you make money. So, okay, you've chosen that group, but there's no need to then make comments to the group that you didn't choose and say, by the way, your thinking is out of date, you should move on. Can you not tell me what type of games I like to play? You want to appeal to that group, you're not going to appeal to me, fine, but then don't come around and say that my choice in gaming is wrong. That does not make good business sense, as I think we were also saying. Wow.
It's also sad that the president of the releasers of Civ 5 are saying it's not contemporary. It's kind of scary, and that what are they going to continue to do with the Civilization franchise?
Sell it.
Yeah, who owns the Civ license? Oh, wait.
Well, they'll just release it on the phone and Facebook, but you know, maybe my glasses have empty with that comment. I don't know.
I see, and you can make the argument that by bringing Civ to even the console, right, with Civilization Revolution a few years ago, because consoles have had that surge with the diversity and the interest, then you can certainly make an argument that PC gaming is not as strong as it used to be, and if you use it in terms of, like, dollar figures, we can't argue with that. But even bringing Civilization to Facebook, like, that's a contemporary take on Civilization, even if we ourselves are not interested in it, and or we're not interested in Civilization Revolution because it's on the console, we can get something. We can all be satisfied to some degree. Maybe you're sacrificing making one particular group completely happy, and some people have drawn kind of a connection to trying to make even strategy games with a more mass appeal, and that you end up with things like Civilization Revolution, which people harp on as a negative thing, or Civilization World, or even some effects that some people are seeing with regards to Civilization 5 as compared to Civilization 4. But
you know, you have some good points there. I was just thinking, based on what you're saying, you know, like, why don't they make some competent games for console that are Civ-like, or maybe Civ itself? I mean, a lot of the criticism from Civ Revolution was just people being fuddy-duddies or whatever about the console thing in general. But console GUIs and controls have evolved a lot now, and I don't see any reason you could not have a game that was modeled precisely like Civ 4 or Civ 5 on console and be able to play it at a decent speed. Certainly faster than most people play on PC anyway, because most people are pretty slow at Civ, as far as I'm concerned. But,
and that's the important thing.
Well, no, but I guess my point is it would not make much difference in playtime. And certainly if you had something like the Wiimote, at that point you almost have computer-like controls. as long as you have a good user interface design. I know that's not really Fraxis' strong suit, given our recent history with both Civ 4 and 5, but even so, if that were done well, you could easily have a controllable turn-based strategy game. And that's part of the reason that they're not mainstream, is that there's no... I mean, Civ Rev aside, I can't think of too many well-known, popular turn-based strategy titles for console. And console's a bigger part of the market, I guess. So what are you going to do with that? You can certainly make a good turn-based strategy for console. They've even done it in the past, back with games like, I don't know, similar models to Final Fantasy Tactics. You could do it. And you could do it well. I don't know if it's up to Firaxis and 2K, but it's something that I think they should have explored with XCOM instead of diving right at a first-person shooter title, which it's hard for me to picture it doing well. I wish them the best of luck if they're going to try it, but I don't know.
And this, we touched upon it about the whole Charles and Wes thing, and he says he likes the example of music artists, and so in other words, could we extrapolate then that as saying if Civilization was new today, or perhaps there was the original Civilization, and we didn't have Civ 2, 3, 4, 5, the Call to Power offshoots, anything like that, that if Civ had been left, as XCOM had been for more than a decade, yes, it's intellectual property, but nobody's doing anything, nobody's doing with it, that Civ would be a first-person shooter today?
Yeah, right. What the hell? That would be stupid.
Don't give them ideas, because Seriously? Apparently that's not out of the realm of possibility.
And please, yes, don't give them ideas. I'm already mad enough about XCOM being a first-person shooter. I mean, I realize you do a lot of shooting in it, but come on, it was a tactical game, and not the Rainbow Six kind of tactical either. Not that Rainbow Six is bad.
They better at least do something like that. They better keep some tactical strategy element in it, or, oh my god...
Well, I think, Mr. Hartman, if you were trying to get press for XCOM because you thought perhaps it wouldn't get that much press, just simply because of, in your own views, it only appeals as it exists to fossils like us 90 gamers, then you have succeeded in generating press. I will give you that. And you may view even negative press as better than no press at all. But certainly there could have been a better way. I mean, just ignore us. I'd rather be ignored, honestly. Sometimes, don't say anything at all. Don't do anything at all. Just, I go my way, you go your way. Maybe that's what we need to do right now. I'm going to move on from you, for Mr. Hartman. And actually, not that I really knew much of anything about you to begin with.
Before we make a fossil out of him.
Oh, Mackie and I will talk later. We'll fart. You know, like I even said, like the 90s generation of gamers all love XCOM and we own the IP, so we thought, okay, what do we do with it?
Derp, let's make it a shooter, because that was totally the most popular genre in the 90s.
We love it, so let's totally change it.
That's right.
Derp. Derp sums up that article pretty well. It just says derp, the entire thing.
It's kind of like, you know, this thing is not broken, but we need to fix it.
Yep.
Maybe XCOM would have been more popular if you made some titles before this, that is. Just saying.
And let's just point out that they did try making it more shooterish with a couple of things, their spinoffs, and everybody still loves the original better. So, guys, not taking an example from what people before you have tried. I think Dan wants to move on.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Let's help that side.
Number 6. From episode 111. Asking then, and still now, the uniqueness of a unit retained through successive upgrades.
Promotions and units, they keep their unique abilities. So the spread was started by Nemesis, 7884, and it goes like this. I read in several posts that sometimes unique units seem to keep their unique abilities and sometimes they do not. This seems to be very interesting and important, so I'm wondering if anyone can tell me about that. Does it only amount to special abilities like plus X percent against Y, or also to general strength improvements, e.g. musketeers keep their plus 4 strength when upgrading to riflemen, etc.? So yeah, the answer to that question is that as of this patch, I believe, they do keep their unique units after promotion, which is nice because Civ 5, you know, incorporates a lot more promotion than supported. You can actually keep a unit, you know, throughout the game and just upgrade them accordingly.
Well, I am afraid by the fact that maybe it brings in imbalance with the fact that earlier unique units have a great advantages because they, then you can benefit from this promotion way longer. I don't know if it's clear.
Yeah. Well, there's a secondary thread that we have linked here that goes to Majin. Yeah. We started a reasonably in-depth analysis of each of the individual unique units, their, you know, their strengths and potential problems with them. Just to give an example, he goes over the Jaguar Warrior and points out that if you manage to never get iron, then you actually cannot upgrade them ever. Whereas if you do, then you can pretty much have them for the majority of the game. So you have issues like that. But, you know, really the other issue is it's always been a problem with early units versus later units when it comes to uniques. You know, they've never been balanced that later uniques are so good that you might consider them comparable in utility to an earlier unique unit. You know, it seems almost always that they just kind of chuck in unique units for flavor rather than worrying about balance. Although certainly in Civ 5, the unique unit bonuses seem to be a little bit more important than in previous games for most uniques. Most.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't know. Their model of them keeping their abilities on upgrade, it has some strategic value to it. I'm not sure I'd want it removed, but certainly I want certain things looked at with, that he's mentioning in this thread. And it's a pretty lengthy thread, and it goes on to a second post. So I'd say it's probably better for the listeners to read it themselves as opposed to us reading out the entire thing on air. But it's a good post. It's worth checking out.
Yeah, it might be a little more interesting for us to read that as compared to, say, reading the Civ 5 manual. But yes, some things are better left read and not said. Ooh, that's interesting. now this is a news flash. I like to talk. But I like JP Bar 81's post, which I guess was copied from an earlier thread, an older thread that talked about this, not that I came across it. But in any event, this keeps it simple for me, and I think this is going to put me at odds with some people on the panel, but so be it. Special bonuses to unique units should only provide the bonus while units maintain their unique identity. If they're upgraded, these special bonuses should be removed. The unique represents a special era and unit to each civ, and their ability shouldn't be applied to the whole span of the game. Also, some uniques are just simply stronger and don't have any unique abilities. When upgraded, they don't retain their higher strength, quote-unquote. And I'll also mention that was partially pointed out in Majin's secondary thread that, for instance, when he's talking about ranged units and he's talking about, you know, the chariot archers, you know, going to knights, the most obvious issue here is the chariot archers keeping their penalties when upgraded to knights. So we're not just talking about those things that are positive, but also those things that are negative that are being inherited. So let's just stop the madness right now. And once they're upgraded, the uniqueness, the good, the bad, the indifferent, the outright stuff, anything to do with the promotion is gone. If it's something that we want to be continuing on, then let's tie it to the unit specifically and not have it be a promotion, which is a separate issue, kind of, so to speak. But just leave the bonuses for that unit, and if they're upgraded, that era has passed, we've moved on.
I thought they patched out some of those negative abilities translating up. Like, I remember the artillery being upgraded to mobile artillery. At one point, still had to have the setup. I thought some of those things were removed. I'm not sure if that's the case now, but probably, I thought, so.
Well, that's progress then. Yeah, and if that's some, then there are still some of them.
But having the balance of uniques with, you know, higher raw strength as opposed to abilities, that and having only one of those upgrades, that doesn't necessarily make it imbalanced. You can easily balance the game around the ability for some units to carry on their upgrades, their abilities through upgrades,
whereas other units don't.
You can balance that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's the best model, but it adds a little bit to gameplay that you didn't see in previous versions, at least.
Yeah, I think when Poster says that it can model also a military tradition into a civ, but it has to be balanced. I don't know. It appears like they did that and then they keep it in a later patch because it was full, but we don't know if it was on purpose, you know. But if balanced, it can be a good thing, yeah.
And you can call serious questions a balance between unique units without having any abilities upgraded at all. Somehow I'm thinking that the abilities upgrade is not the issue here. When you're comparing things like even post-patch companion cavalry to something like the Panzer or, you know, Immortals to the Panzer, anything early that gives a big return, you'd be hard-pressed for the Panzer to matter in the majority of games where those early uniques tend to matter consistently.
I think just in part it's balance, but also it gives you some additional decisions to make with regards to, I could upgrade this unique unit, but if I know I'm going to lose these bonuses, is that actually going to, in fact, be an upgrade? If I really took advantage of my unique unit when it came about and it has all of these promotions, and I look at, okay, this is what its strength is going to be, you know, its combat, defense, movement, whatever combinations thereof, I guess maybe not so much movement, but other things in that respect, you may decide, no, I don't actually want to upgrade those because these ones that are particularly upgraded, no, I'm not going to be able to build them anymore, but they're in a position that they're actually just as well off, if not better, than something that could be upgraded or built new, so I'll use that gold for a new unit entirely, or I'll use it for something else completely, and just leave some of those unique units in the game rather than feeling like, oh, yes, let's go ahead and upgrade those units, so now they've kept all of their benefits plus the base value improvement of whatever unit they've now upgraded to.
Well, I do like Imagine's second post in which he points out that during the tech tree, when you receive certain units, you usually receive the counter unit to the, I guess, following unit. His under the heading Pointy Sticks versus Speed Units, he says that it all seems rather slapped together without anyone stopping to look at the big picture. So the issue is that pikes are a prerequisite to knights, and the anti-tank gun comes before tanks are invented. But I think that it was always that way.
Counter units in Civ 4 are consistently available before the units themselves, or at the same time. They might have done that on purpose, for better or worse, I don't know, but that seems like it's been a consistent situation in the game, really, as long as counter units have existed in the proper sense.
Yeah, that seemed purposeful.
Yeah,
and obviously, back in Civ 3, you had defense values and attack values. It was a little bit different. You didn't have true counter units, quote-unquote. But ever since Civ 4, they've put in counters ahead of time. I think that's to balance and not have somebody totally get steamrolled before they could react, I think.
I do like his point that, you know, like the spearman, pikeman bonus can be pretty high versus mounted because it's way overpowered at 100%. Well, I don't know. What are you saying about the whole, the fact that hoplites can stand toe-to-toe with cavalry with fortified and mercenary? That doesn't seem quite right to me. I mean, it's not like spearman versus tank, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure that advantage of retaining that particular unique unit for that long when you're facing units of that much farther down the tech tree, even with the bonuses that you can get to it as it is right now, to say that it's comparable that a hop would be going after a cavalry. And I haven't seen that myself, but, you know, as Magin was pointing out, that does seem to be a bit on the extreme side.
I don't know. I think the pikemen units, or the anti-mounted in general, need their bonuses. Although the horsemen was a little over-nerfed, I think they could have kept their strength closer to what it was and just kept their weaknesses against cities in place like they have now. Anyway, they are, despite the fact that spears are strong against them, you could routinely beat spears, at least AI spears, using them just because of their mobility. You can hit and run, hit and run, hit and run. And, you know, without something that has a huge bonus against them, it would be very difficult to stop them at all or inflict any actual casualties, because they could just run away after attacking you. And it would be hard to stick them in places where you could kill them instantly without them reacting.
Are you saying, yeah, having kept horsemen, like they were 12 strength and then they got down to 10, so...
Yeah, but make them pretty terrible against cities or something, or maybe make them 11 strength than what they are now, I don't know. It just seems like they were made to the point where they're even a little bit weak in the field now because of that, and I don't mean just weak in the field compared to other units, but like if you compare them to mounted from other eras, which did not take an absolute decrease in strength. Like, you know, knights are still 18 strength, cavalry is still at 25, and they have all their mobility. They're just weaker against cities than they used to be. So they're, you know, otherwise as good as mounted ever was in the field. That's not true for a horseman. So I don't know. It seems like they were perhaps just hit a little bit too hard with the nerf bat, although I can see why they did it, since it was the overwhelming strategy until it was done.
In the context of the greater picture, I can see that. I mean, if we're talking about knocking it down to 11 instead of 12, okay, so instead of a 20% reduction on its base strength, it's now 11%. But, of course, we've also got the hit against the cities with the two. Okay, I'm okay with what they did with it. Maybe the other mounted units should have also been addressed as well.
I don't see mounted as a big problem right now anymore.
let's inject some artificial controversy. You know what is overpowered? Scouts. They shouldn't be able to move. Penalty movement at all. It's absolutely outrageous.
And you can keep that terrain move up by upgrading. Oh my god, it's ridiculous.
Oh wow, that is kind of ridiculous, actually.
Ridiculously fun.
I don't know, I would like to upgrade destroyers to missile cruisers. It just makes sense to me. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to upgrade destroyers to missile cruisers. Not a lot of people get to that point in the game anyway, so it's maybe people overlook it, but I don't know.
Well, technically speaking, you could not upgrade destroyers to missile cruisers in Civ 4 either, technically. Because it was battleships that you upgraded. Do missile cruisers detect submarines? I've never actually built a missile cruiser, I do not believe. So that might be something useful to have from a destroyer.
Only destroyers can notice submarine, if I can correctly.
If that's how the mechanic is, then that gives you some incentive to keeping destroyers and makes it make slightly more sense. I still don't know why you wouldn't be able to do that upgrade just as an option, but whatever. Some minor justification there.
Yeah, no, missile cruisers can't see submarines.
Something that Imagine said was negative defensive lancers. I've never actually used lancers extensively just for this reason, because if you try to attack a city with lancers, you can lose like almost a third of your overall health just from like one bombardment by a city, you know? And if you happen to be in a bad place, you can get that twice from neighboring cities. And I would much rather have something else, you know, just because pikes are effective counter to both knights and lancers and even cavalry sometimes.
Yeah, I think Civ always needs to have a couple black sheep units in there. You know, you got some ironclads in Civ 4 or something, you know, maybe defend your seafood resources, but otherwise they're pretty trashy. Or, you know, grenadiers in a lot of cases, although they can be good. Frequently they're not because the opponent already has cavalry and you just can't do anything with them. And I think the Civ 5 Lancers fall into that category. You get these guys that just, they can't defend for anything. So you can't really use them offensively too effectively because there's at least something that can hit them in most cases. And if you want to go strict defense, yeah, they can help. But if you're actually putting effort into strict defense, you can probably beat most of the things that attack you anyway. Not to mention that you are not guaranteed to be having masses of cavalry and cavalry alone on the defensive, especially now that cavalry cannot attack cities as effectively. So lancers just they're kind of left in the cold there. And they're an option, but they don't seem to make a huge difference in the game for the vast majority of cases. It might be annoying if the AI surprises you with one or something like that, but when push comes to shove, they're just not that good.
Yeah, I wish we had something that was equivalent to Curasaurs in the last game. And I feel like it was a good level unit, and I don't really know what the difference is between a knight and a lancer, although, I mean, there must be one. But, I mean, the difference between cuirassiers and cavalry makes sense, right? I mean, it's muskets to rifles.
Yes, so lancer here, 4 movement, 22 combat, we mentioned the cavalry at 25 combat, and 3 movements. Lancer is a little cheaper at 220 hammers as compared to 260. And if we compare that to the knight, because the lancer comes between the knight and the cavalry unit, that was 18 strength for the knight and 3 movement, but only 150 hammers. So it's when they say it comes in between, it does really feel like not only does it come in between like in terms of the tech tree, but also kind of comes in between in terms of its actual strength and abilities as well. Plus also with that additional movement as well is nice as well. It gets back to the horseman movement level too.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is the negative promotion that they have on defense, which I don't remember how much reduced that is, but I remember in Civ 4, it was only that, you know, you wouldn't get any defensive bonuses, but you wouldn't actually have a negative effect for being mounted. Lancers just kind of suck in that regard, and it's especially easy to kill them.
As Magic pointed out in the chat, that Lancers can upgrade to AT guns and helicopters. I always love that ability for mounted units to upgrade into these air-mounted units, these air units.
Yeah.
if only that worked in real life, that would be an awesome show.
That's really not any worse than when you take something like a galleon or frigate and all of a sudden it is a metal naval unit that is many times its size and capacity.
That's just known as the genie effect. The leader of the civilization found a magic lamp, and the genie granted them 3 wishes. And their first wish was that they would be able to upgrade these units ad infinitum until the end of time. So
more like they had to make a giant lamp out of the gold it costs.
Well, you're turning like an actual person into a boat and then making it travel across the ocean.
That's right, so whip those boats out. You'll feel like a fighter jet made of biceps. Literally.
Number 10 from episode 111.
Sorry about that. And I knew I was going to do that. And myself, Lisa Fang, or QNL.
Yeah, we'll just mispronounce your username at least.
I know, my own username.
Yeah, so this is Lisa LNQ, and am I wrong? Oh, my bad.
No, it's not a palindrome. What's the episode?
If you mess up my name, just go with me and cheese or something. It works as well.
It's thematically appropriate.
Absolutely.
No, your team in me the, actually. See, so it doesn't work with Mackie's, though, unless it's...
Just start with Lua and then go with something else.
Yeah, Kalua Mach.
Yeah, Kalua. I mean, how could that be wrong?
Yeah, I could use some right now.
That would definitely raise the quality of the show. I recommend it to
you. Anything would raise the quality of the show. And, that's one of those internal thoughts again. Whoops.
Number 9 from episode 125.
Well, I'll just have to place that in post-production. We'll just have to forget that, and we'll jump right into the introduction.
I was afraid you were going to say you were going to have to sing it.
Well, it is instrumental. I could try it.
Mackie, where are you? There's a reason you're not supposed to be late.
You still want to do the introduction, right? You didn't change your mind.
Get you to stop singing, I'll do it, sure.
Number 8 from episode 130.
I used to play this game when I was like 10. I don't know if you ever played like Ancient Egypt or something. Was it called Ancient Egypt? No.
I don't know if you've played this game.
Well, I don't know if I played it either. No. Okay, never mind.
Don't remember the title, but have you played it? There's this game. I mean, there's a gorilla, and have you guys played that game from 10 years ago with the gorilla?
And you're like not supposed to die. I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? You're supposed to win.
Yeah.
High score.
You're going for that objective. You know, the objective that allows you to beat the game.
Number 7 from episode 119.
Actually, a little bit back to Civ World in a sense. Just there was an article on blog.games.com about an upcoming game. It's talking about Facebook games from Zynga. I didn't pronounce that properly, right, Zynga?
Who cares?
Well, the almost the company is valued at almost $1 billion. They might have something to say about it.
that's totally $1 billion of real money. They have it in a vault and they swim in it every day.
Just like Scrooge McDuck.
I was thinking just like in DuckTales.
DuckTales.
Mackie and I are on the same wavelength again.
Number 6 from episode 115.
It's a statue of the bear that you killed in the ancient era.
Commemorating all the settlers who lost their lives to bear cavalry.
Not the bear cavalry.
There's no stopping bear cavalry.
Except with a wall.
No, that stops regular cavalry, but bear cavalry not so much.
Well, now, if you have bear cavalry and you attack them with other bear cavalry, does that not cancel them out?
No, it just kills everything around. Basically, it creates a shockwave. Basically, destroys the planet.
Nice. It's a good way to lose the game.
You have been defeated by the bear nuke.
Number 5 from episode 131. Parsing base game from downloadable content material in Civilization.
In order to get these wonders, you have to pay for the downloadable content. The wonders are just not tied to the specific scenario. You can build these in the base game, but assuming you have the DLC. But Skyder says that now the downloadable content is, quote, you're starting to piecemeal out parts of the core game. I fear this new DLC, when you're charging us for money for standard in-game wonders, will be a harbinger of worse things to come. What's next? Will we have to pay money for additional resources, technology, and units? This will truly be a travesty, unquote. I think if we look just back at Civilization IV, we did not have downloadable content, but we had expansion packs. And let's look at the second and last expansion pack for Civ IV, Beyond the Sword. Can't remember what specifically, but I'm sure, and I meant to look this up to be more specific, but I'm sure it introduced wonders. New wonders. I don't know how you can talk about a wonder of the world being part of the core game when you don't have it already, and it's not necessarily you're going to have this anyway in the course of a game. Like if suddenly, you know, 2K and Firaxis said, okay, would you like mounted units in the game? That's downloadable content. Okay, then I might start to see, okay, that's like a core game issue. I don't feel that we're being slighted by having these wonders as part of downloadable content, although, you know, I can see where he's coming from. I don't feel that negatively about it.
Well, there's still some things I would rather see first, such as significant improvement to hotkeys and controls in the game. Just, you know, lots of little minor things, like queuing up units in cities that's been problematic for about a year. You know, things like that I would rather see before the wonders, but I agree with you, Dan. This isn't something where, like, people who have DLC get an advantage and people don't have it, have a disadvantage then. And it's not like these wonders were necessarily required to play Civ 5 Vanilla effectively.
Right.
Probably not, but who knows. My guess is no, based on past. But yeah, if they worked in multiplayer, but only available for some people, then I'd have a major issue with it. That's overstepping. If it starts ruining competition like that, it's not good. I don't hear any evidence of that happening. I think DLC in general doesn't work too well in the multiplayer, right? So,
you see, that was actually another discussion within there, is that some people were saying, hey, if I bought the downloadable content, I should be able to use it in multiplayer, the end. But I disagree with that, because what happens right now is, in Civilization V, if you want that downloadable content included, then every person who is joining your game has to have that downloadable content installed. Even if nobody uses it, even if everybody goes random and you don't roll it, and AI doesn't roll it if you don't have it, if there's one person that doesn't have it, they cannot join your game. You get you'd have incompatible downloadable content. The thing is, you can have it, you can have it as part of your account. I can go and get Korea, but when I set up the game, you check off what downloadable content you want to be enabled for that game. So if I know I'm the only one with Korea, and all five people I'm playing with don't, then I just don't check that box. And now you don't have to worry about someone choosing to use that in a multiplayer game because they have access to it and nobody else does. Now, if somebody wanted to go in and mod that so that could happen, I don't even know if that's even technically possible. But if it is, that's the way to go about it, as opposed to case in Civ 4.
There was no issue there. You had the same patch version, they had the same expansion, and you played, or you didn't, and you couldn't.
There you go. So, it's good the way it is, actually.
Well, version compatibility has become an issue. There's no denying that.
With Civ 4 or Civ 5?
With Civ 5. Just because you can't use your DLC, because nobody else is going to have bought the exact same DLC, or much fewer people. So you're going to wind up not being able to use DLC in multiplayer frequently. And that is a concern we expressed way back before any of this even started, but it is what it is. It's the way companies are going now. And if everyone has it, you can use it, so it's not the worst thing.
Again, with an industry perspective here, even in this day and age, the vast majority of games that are sold, people just play offline. Like, for instance, Unreal Tournament 2004, I think it was hugely successful in multiplayer, but still, like, 98% of the people who bought it only played offline. So that's probably the same situation with Civ 5. Yeah, I'm serious.
Oh, my God.
So they had to cater to the offline crowd, even though the hardcore people...
I didn't realize it was that ludicrous.
It's pretty silly, yeah.
Because that game is, like, built for multiplayer.
I know, I know.
You have such a huge single-player component to the game, and people compete on the single-player component aspect of the game. Unreal Tournament to me for multiplayer. Wow, just to have 2% of people playing online, that's interesting.
I guess there's a lot more people out there than we know that just, you know, browse through the store and they say, this looks cool, they pick it up, they play it a few times, they put it down, but that's where the majority of the income and the revenue comes from publishing a game.
I see. Well, yeah, then from an industry standpoint, you'd have to go for the mass of your purchasers. There's no way.
But again,
go to rallies and things along those lines. If
exactly,
you know, if we're on a podcast here, then we're definitely not the normal user in any way, shape, or form.
No, we're superior. I mean, no, yeah, continue.
clearly. If we include all listeners, you guys are also superior, just you know, to clear things up. It's only if you're not listening that makes you inferior.
That's true, yes. You're all podcasters in a way. Even if you are not actually on a podcast, if you listen to podcasts, you are a podcaster.
True. I would say anybody that's listening in to a podcast of Civ 5 is in the minority, but the flag-bearing minority that kind of dictates the direction the game is taking. But you got to realize we're not the masses.
No, we're the landed elite. And
true story. 15% growth. The internet elite, for that matter, yes.
You mentioned, Phil, about how we were discussing last year with regards to, you know, downloadable content and not being able to use it in multiplayer. And if I was part of that, maybe I should... Can't remember the specifics of exactly what I said. Even, man, that does make me sound old a little bit. But I like how it is right now that if you want to play with the downloadable content, then you want to find somebody or somebody else that also has that same downloadable content. I mean, some people suggest, hey, if one person buys the downloadable content, then somebody who's joining that game should have the use of that downloadable content for that multiplayer game in and of itself. But I think I guess I can kind of see that in a way, because then you say, well, then they don't have the single-player experience, and it just goes away. But I think that the downloadable content, if you have that, if one person has it and somebody else doesn't, then it can become a focal point in terms of either only one person can play that particular Civ in a particular game, but I think it's actually everybody could choose to be the same civilization, kind of like in Civilization 4. You know, what color of Incan are you? I like that distinction. And just have it so that, you know, if you don't have the downloadable content, then nobody can play with it. I can see the minor point where someone says that, Mongolia shouldn't be included on that list because it's free. Well, you do have to add it. You know, it's not like a patch where it's automatically pushed to you. You have to go and say, yes, add this. So I wouldn't call it like a version mismatch if some people are playing with downloadable content and others not. Get really frustrated if suddenly we had to pay for like these patches, for instance, that are addressing stuff in-game as of the base game, as it were. But as far as downloadable content goes, I don't see we need any change when it comes to the multiplayer component.
Yeah, it's not ideal just because you have fewer total people in the pool that have the same versions of the game and are going to play the same version of the game. But I think when you go with the DLC model, they're doing it the best way that you can do it under the DLC model. So I don't really have any complaints in that regard.
I agree. It's impossible to make everybody happy, but they, I'm sure, have sat down just like we're sitting here, discussed it, figured out what's going to work. They probably even run numbers behind it, and they're doing what they can with it, and I think they've got the best setup.
I think it's cost benefit from their side. I mean, you know, the people that are playing single-player content are the people who are paying like those games for them. And, you know, as a result of that, I just think they're probably unwilling to invest the effort in dealing with the technical challenges to make the DLC broadly available and over there.
You know, Sparkle makes an interesting point in the chat that from a company point of view, letting others use your downloadable content in multiplayer, that they might then buy it for their single-player games in turn. I mean, good from a business point of view, and you could argue that if it's good from a business point of view, then the company is still going to be paying attention to the game, making more downloadable content, and as some people have actually noted in here, it's good that there's downloadable content and it's coming out in segments because then the company is getting a continuous revenue stream, not just from those people picking up Civ 5 after the fact, buying as a gift for someone, waiting for it to become heavily discounted, as Steam likes to do with their weekend deals. I can see that from like a business point of view, you know, but letting the user downloadable content in multiplayer that they might, you know, get it for their single player games. I guess I'm not in and of itself objecting to that. I could come over to that point of view.
Well, I like it. I think that's a great idea that you could just let people use it sort of for free online, but then since the majority of the games are played offline anyway, you'd have to pay for it offline. There would still be incentive for people to buy it, and most people would not be online to get the free copy in the first place, so you wouldn't be losing out on much revenue. So I think that's a good idea. Whether they'll go that way or not is for us to say.
It's an interesting point, because as I pointed out earlier, we're, you know, the typical online multiplayer gamer is apparently not the largest part of your audience. So it's not like people would be getting access to the Civ in multiplayer to the extent that it just wouldn't be sold for single-player content purposes.
Hey, and on that note, it would be good because it could get people playing online that would normally not be playing online because there's free stuff, right? So everybody likes free stuff, and it would build up a community, possibly?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, it might draw extra people to the game. I'm not sure if that would make more money or less money for them, but it's certainly something to look at, and it sounds like a good idea, especially because it would make games more compatible.
And that's the really nice part, is that you wouldn't have to care about version mismatch because everybody's got it all.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, increase the likelihood that everybody would have it all, because, hey, essentially, in that situation like Sparkle is describing, then just like there's a demo for Civilization V, there's the way that you can get the, air quote, demo of the new downloadable content.
Number 4, from episode 130. Dealing with critters in multiplayer of any game is part and parcel of the mode. So what of it in Civ specifically?
The next topic is on critters in multiplayer. So this guy is actually talking about how he quit after getting a bad game, basically, that just didn't turn out that well for him. And it's just that it was annoying that people that he was playing multiplayer with were quitting because they just weren't having fun. There was basically a monstrous AI that kind of made the game unfun for them. And is there a way to, like, keep people who are going to quit anyway out of a multiplayer game? Short of what he said. Noting names and blacklisting people who do it without any explanation. Which may prove fruitless, as so many people do it. I find the first reply funny, because he's just like, yeah, this is why I keep Excel spread. You're going to have to bleep this. Did you see it? You see it? He spells
sheet. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, he's an Excel spreadsheet with banded ball.
Spreadsheet.
With
abandoned people.
And resigning, I guess.
Yeah, other than that typo, I think that's actually an important distinction between people who quit and people who resign. And to me, a definition of a quitter in a Civ game, some people talk about, well, they're in a bad situation. I'm going to even give like a base qualification, which is they leave the game without saying anything, whether that's voice or that's in text. Now, at the same time, someone typing, I'm leaving, 1 second, and then the next sentence, second, leaving, could also question whether or not that's someone quitting and they're just trying to save face.
This is interesting, because at one point does a loss or a losing position become a blown game? Like, I can see people quitting when they can't possibly win. And certainly, I feel there needs to be a mechanic. I guess I want to say a good manners resignation, or, you know, just admitting defeat, where it credits the other person with the victory, essentially. And I would like to see something like that, because then it would be less grating to have someone just quit. Now, the people who are really a problem are those, like Colonel Bogey says. Like, they'll join a game, you'll get in 10, 15 turns, they're certainly not out of the game yet, and they'll just quit. That's really bad. If you're looking at a long game, it can be really frustrating to lose half hour, hours, just because people are quitting and you have to start a new game and they quit, start a new game again. I would like to see some kind of mechanic that shows somebody up as a known quitter, where you can resign and not be penalized for it. But if you just quit at the start like that, it does reflect poorly, and then have some sort of mechanic where you can discuss it with the rest of the players or whatever, as you will. But certainly this is a problem in multiplayer, and it's not a unique problem, this Civilization V, by any means.
You know, right now there are a couple of out-of-game mechanisms in the form of Civ Players League, as well as the Steam group, so this one being specifically for Civilization V, called No Quitters, which is trying to have it so that people are agreeing to, I'm going to say Civ Players specifically to start with, specific rules that talks about no quitting. And if you are someone who consistently quits, then you are going to get a bad reputation and your ranking is going to be affected, or your labeling is going to be affected somehow. With No Quitters, it's an invite-only group, so they would have to see or hear or at least have the perception that you're not someone that is going to quit, and if you do quit, then you're going to find yourself kicked out of the group, and I get the impression, good luck of ever getting back in. Some of the extremes to the No Quitters, for example, I read that their rule is that you can only quit when you lose your capital city, that anything other than that, or before that, you know, short of, you know, like the power goes out or the house, like your house on fire or something like that, is not an acceptable reason to quit.
How do you prove that, though? Like, here's a picture of my house that's burned down. Like, people could just take any picture.
Picks. Yes, picks. But I think saying that you have to wait until your capital is taken is a bit extreme, but I get the idea of, you want to be able to have, you know, a record of these things, a tally of these things, and try to build up, you know, not only the talk about, you know, reputation in terms of the negative, but you might also want to be able to do something positive, have a positive reputation as someone who, even if, you know, they're in the dire situation, that they are going to stay in the game until they die, until there is no hope, or they're someone who graciously resigns at a particular point in the game and acknowledges a reason why. You've got your friends list, for example. It'd be nice if you have a game, a multiplayer game, you're randomly matched up, that from that particular list, competitors, so that it could include someone's username, because unless I remembered it or I took a screenshot or wrote it down, may have no other way of contacting these individuals again or remembering who they are. So then after the game is over, in terms of a formal mechanism here, be able to say, okay, you played this game with this person, you left, or the game ended, or whatever, then some kind of ranking in terms of, you know, they quit, or they resigned, or they stayed until the end. So that way you didn't have to strictly rely on a Civ Players or a No Quitters League, which, you know, depending upon your nature, may or may not benefit you. Like, I mean, Canuck Soldier from Civ Players says that their system works best with people competitive in nature, as they care about their record. Even if we have the kind of system in the world, right, there's still going to be people that probably enjoy quitting, probably enjoy messing up games, if that's how they get their jollies. And then I think the question also becomes not only how do we deal with quitters in terms of preventing it, but what should happen to the game afterwards? And some people really got into it about how it shouldn't be that the AI takes over that Civ, and some people said that's because the AI will do worse than the human player, or some people say that now the AI is going to take over and get an unfair advantage as compared to the human player, so it's going to be worse for everybody else. But if nothing else, what else would you do when someone quits? What would you have, just the Civ be completely eliminated off the map? Would you have some sort of mechanism where then it divides the cities somehow between the remaining players? I think the AI takeover is really the only practical way to go about it. I think the focus is on the prevention rather than the cure, which is trying to get people not to quit in the first place.
AIs can still screw up the game. I mean, certainly they're easier to kill, and if somebody quits early and is taken over by an AI, where, like, say you have a four-person game free-for-all, and one person quits and it's an AI, well, his neighbor can probably crush him very, very easily and early, especially if the in-game difficulty isn't set too high, whereas the rest of the players, if they're all competitive, are going to be struggling against each other and having to worry about their early defenses more. It's going to be a huge advantage for whoever's near that AI.
And for that point, I really don't see how something, a mechanism in game, can really do anything to help you. It might recommend some suggestions, but in the end, it's going to be the other human players needing to talk to each other. But I'm not really sure there's viable mechanism to put into the game other than maybe some sort of algorithm that looks at, okay, it's the first X number of turns. Percentage of players that are no longer playing and AI has taken over is 50% or greater or something. Have a dialogue box that pops up and suggests perhaps you might want to restart. And, of course, have the option to disable such things if you find that annoying. But beyond that, it really comes down, again, to the human equation.
Yeah, I think the reasonable thing to do is just to tell people, like, a few turns ahead of time that you need to quit. It's not like I don't know. You can just have a little bit of self-control and wait a couple of turns while you tell them. Or, like, I don't know, if somebody's pretty close to you, they can afford it, get some of your cities to them. If they want it, of course. If it's a free-fall situation, then I don't know. I mean, does it really matter, though? I guess you could just quit and give your cities to an AI. But, like, isn't that a little bit spiteful? Like, maybe a little bit? I'm not playing this game anymore, but I still care that you don't win.
It does bother me that someone would quit and give cities over to another faction.
Well, if it were you,
I would rather all the players try to win.
If it were you, would you be more inclined to be in favor?
Sort of, but not really. Because what happens is the person receiving cities, well, at least if there's more cost for receiving cities, but the person receiving it gets such an overwhelming advantage that it would be hard to refuse them because then they're just going to give them to somebody else. But at the same time, you know, it's a really hollow victory to win because somebody else just quit and now the game is ruined. You know, that doesn't really feel like a win. So, yes and no. It bothers me in general that people play games this way, not just Civ, but any game. Just out of spite, they completely alter the outcome of the game without any attempt at winning themselves. That's really frustrating, and those are the people I'd really rather not play with if given a choice. I'd rather play people who are better than me 24/7 than play with people who do things like that.
Yes, because then you feel like, hey, there's a sense of progression here and purpose, and I could actually learn something from that other player. Whereas the people who just end up quitting and they're kind of, you know, they're stacking the deck in favor of somebody else, you know, what's the purpose in the multiplayer? I should just play single player.
Yeah. It really turns the game more into a popularity contest than how well you played the game, which it's not so good. Not so good for the quality of gameplay.
So I think a lot of it comes down to accountability first and foremost on each individual player. That if you are going to leave a game, I'm going to use the generic term here, if you're going to leave a game, you're going to leave the game because you're quitting or because you're resigning to come back to that distinction. And as you said at the outset, Phil, there could be situations where through no fault of your own, or perhaps you made some critical mistakes and now you're behind the eight ball, you see that, oh, I might be able to dig myself out of this hole, but it's going to take so long that it's not going to be worth it, so I'm going to resign, because there's nothing like, oh, you need to stay in the game until, you know, such and such a turn, or until if and when your capital is taken. And you're just sitting there turn after turn after turn and not having any fun. I mean, it is supposed to be about fun. But I think the responsibility also comes to people if you know a particular user is consistently someone who quits, then to report that. I'm not necessarily saying report to Steam, get their account disabled, grr. what I mean is just so you're aware, if you choose to play with this person, then there's a considerable possibility that they are going to quit on you because this was my experience.
Sort of like a reference system.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I've never played multiplayer. Does it show up with people randomly?
No, you
join a game.
That people are running. It can be with your friends or just somebody random if you like.
Hosts can kick players from, and Civ 5 from
the lobby.
But you do see their name before you start the game.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So you won't be starting a game and then realize it's somebody that has quit on you before, if you're the type that remembers names, etc.
Yeah, the only limit with that is you can kick the player and they can keep coming back in at infinitum, though.
Ew, that's not good.
So I think in that situation, then you could say, well, yes, you could set it to be a private game, but then if you set it to a private game, then you need to have specific people in mind to play, which you might have, but if you're someone who, especially for instance, doesn't, say, want to get into the forum community and get to know some people, then it's, well, yes, I would like to eventually have private games because I'd like to just play with like 5 or 6 people, but you need to know who those 5 or 6 people are, and if you're always playing a private game, then how are you ever going to find those 5 or 6 people that you would actually like to play with? So it defeats the purpose. So I think with the kicking is good, but then you need to be able to say, for this game or any game that I host, this person is excluded. But once the game actually starts itself, I'm not aware on Civ 5 specifically, just because it's the thing that I'm thinking of the most at the moment, I don't think that there is a way that you can actually kick a player other than to say, okay, I'm going to re-host the game, which in and of itself has its own issues. So that would be something nice to add that would give kind of a local measure, an individual measure, some sort of control over who's in the game and who's not. shall we resign ourselves from this topic and move on?
Well, sadly, there's always going to be jerks in whatever game you play.
Number 3, from episode 110. Stealth as a worker. The who, when, and why of this practice is recurring.
Hi, Awkward Silence.
Ah, yes, welcome to Awkward Silence. I'm just looking over our topics list here and trying to think of a good segue into another topic, but I'll defer my having to make that decision and ask, Phil, what topic shall we go on to next?
Oh, fine. Let's take a look at worker steals. The thread you linked here is by Tresso, I think so. And he asks, is it always worth it in the beginning of the game, mainly if you are planning to wipe a civ from the world? And worker stealing has been around in Civilization as long as I've played it, at least. Maybe not in Civ 1, because I think the worker and cell are the same unit, but after that, It's always been something you could do, and it's always something you see routinely in Hall of Fame games. And we got some discussion going down this list on this particular thread, talking about when you should and shouldn't do it. Apparently you can always get away with one declaration on a city-state to snipe a worker, and a lot of times you can even do it with AI and pick up workers. Anytime you can safely do it, and you know, it won't like ruin your game plan otherwise, it's a pretty big advantage, because you get a very nice boost right at the start of the game. Virtually any situation like that, definitely do it. Otherwise, I mean, I don't know, you might have to worry about diplomacy a little bit, but I'm not sure what the long-term ramifications are of that if nobody's met you other than, you know, your worker steal target.
I think it's mentioned in this thread how some people kind of allude to, you know, when it comes to your first worker, you know, wait till you can go grab a city-state worker. I think either, no. As it's pointed out, it takes too long. You can either rush by it or you can construct it yourself. So do that, and then, I mean, when it comes to, look, there happens to be a worker that's been captured by a barbarian. Was it a city-state worker? Was it another civ, quote-unquote proper civs worker? You may or may not find out if and when you actually capture that worker. If the worker is undefended and roaming around, you know, as Phil said, if you've only met, you know, one or two other civs, early enough on in the game, I think the impact is going to be minimal. Even if they're really, really, really pissed off, unless they happen to be that much stronger than you and have their military in a position such that they can take advantage of that, I think you're going to be all right. I mean, if that's the only kind of attack that you do, you're probably going to be looking at a Cold War situation. And as someone else pointed in the thread, it's not only about gaining workers, particularly when it comes to like a quote-unquote proper AI or a city-state to a lesser extent. You're denying them that worker so that they have to go out of their way to construct another worker when they could have been, in fact, constructing else while you're getting that much farther ahead. Once, of course, you move the worker into wherever it is that you want. I got no problem with stealing workers most of the time.
The only thing I worry about with doing it is starting a chained announcement again. Is if you piss off one AI, it's going to stay pissed off, possibly. And if it does that long enough to just denounce you, then it could turn badly. So I guess it's also a question of who else you've met, really, and who else you think you'll meet in the near future. One thing I don't see being discussed a lot here, and that amazes me, is whether or not this is exploitative or unfair. Almost always when you see these worker steal threads crop up, there's somebody presenting that argument. And I think I went through the entire first page, and nobody complained about it being cheap. And I love that. That is a very good thing. I congratulate Civ 5 Strategy and Tips for not doing that, or not making a big deal of it. Because I always get tired of seeing, like, X strategy is an exploit, you can't do it. And it's part of the game. It was left in the game for a reason. You know, Firaxis is ignorant. If they wanted to block you from worker stealing, they absolutely could. And it actually could. There'd be no trouble at all doing that.
Hey, talk to the barbarians about it being an exploit. They do worker steal all the time.
Yeah, they'll spawn a unit and telefrag you with their 3-movement spawn attacks.
Yeah, it's like, what? My worker's been captured. What are you talking about? There wasn't a barbarian there last turn. Oh, jeez.
There is now.
That's where barbs are handy. They do the worker steal for you. You kind of subcontract it out that way.
Too bad you couldn't contact the barbarians and say, hey, You know what?
Yeah, see Egypt over there? Could you steal their workers for me? Thanks.
That'd be great.
That's bonus for you.
Now, yeah.
That'd be interesting if you could pay gold to the barbarians to make them attack in a different sieve.
That'd be fun, and then somehow the AI would know about you barbarians on us.
Barbarians? I don't know any barbarians. Except you.
Drop the camp near them. Just keep spamming camps.
The only thing, I wouldn't say you wouldn't have to watch, and it's just kind of a quirky sort of thing, but I do find it amusing how if, use the barbarian workers, the best example, like if it's protected by someone and you decide, oh, you're actually going to bombard that, so you've got an archer nearby or something. I love how the ability that you can actually injure the worker by bombarding it, and I've made that mistake a couple of times. It's like, oh, I could have just moved in and captured it. What the heck am I doing? Like, pay attention, Dan.
So do we have anything else on worker stealing? I mean, as long as you can pull it off, it seems like it's generally solid. So
just not relying on it is all. And I know some people get into, oh, but later on in the game, you know, I just end up deleting workers because there's nothing left for them to do. Well, they are good cannon fodder. They're good cannon fodder. Here, why don't you come out of that city there, or come out of that tile that's got good defensive value, and go after my undefended worker. Yes, please do. Okay, poof. There you go. That was a mistake. There, congratulations. You were able to capture my worker for one turn and do absolutely nothing with it, and I was able to take that unit out. That would have been a lot more time and effort. I appreciate that.
That strategy's been around for a while, too, actually.
You can try it on humans. You probably have some variable results there. They'll probably learn, too. That's the other thing.
Yeah, it might work a few times, but then that person, if you play with them, go, oh, they're doing it again.
That's not going to work on anybody good.
So that just means you can't play with the same people very often. You know, you play with, okay, I've had one or two games with you, now you've got that, now I've got to find somebody else who doesn't know my tricks. All right.
Number 2 from episode 126. Though in the context of Civ 5, the pros and cons of moving from a starting settler position are not new considerations.
Moving the starting settler position in Civ 5, that started by Fury Crab, and basically, he says, simple question, looking for good reasons you would move your initial settler, more specifically, reasons you would move him so that you would lose one or more than one turn, and how quick do you feel you get a return on that investment? Assuming you're not reloading and whatnot, because, you know, safe scumming is awesome for winning, but not so awesome for playing legitimately, I suppose. But what are some reasons to move the starting settler losing turns? I don't know. It's pretty rare in all the Civilization games I've played that you really want to spend too long moving around. I mean, maybe you can get away with it on Settler or something. I've heard stories when people are playing those Hall of Fame games, moving their settlers everywhere. But I think for a standard play, you don't want to be caught moving around too long because it just slows down everything. To a large extent, the returns you get from developing your empire early snowball, and every turn you spend not having settled the city delays that entire process from go. Unless you see some really powerful resources that are, you know, just, you know, a move or two away or something that could make your opening faster, I'd hesitate to advocate moving a whole lot.
I would agree with that. I don't think there's a lot of reasons for moving from your starting position unless you really, really had bad luck, got started in a wasteland or something, and you can see like 5 resources on the horizon that you really would rather have your capital based at.
One thing I saw just now in the thread, quite a few people said to settle defensive positions, and that is a valid point, especially on high levels in Civ 5. The AI does have a bit of a tendency lately to early rush you, so if you want to get some extra defense by settling on a hill, that's a pretty justifiable reason, actually. But other than that, I don't know. Someone saying settle on a luxury for trade. Yeah, I guess you could do that. You usually don't want to use a bunch of turns to do it, but whatever.
And the longer you take to settle your capital, the more vulnerable you are to being booted by barbarians. Now that's just shameful.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to die to barbs and Civ 5, but you can definitely get yourself screwed over by them. Start losing your workers and getting your improvements pillaged, and you'll be set far enough back. But they don't kill you anymore, usually.
If you were spending, like, 10 turns trying to find the ideal city spot, and you only had a
settler. Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's my point.
Oh man, I can't even conceive waiting that long. Yeah, but I guess that could happen. I don't know how that works.
In the 10 turns, you would have like one scout, maybe even two warriors or two scouts or whatever. So on standard speed, it would just be ridiculous to start moving around for more than 10 turns, even 5 turns.
Really more than one turn. You know, if you have to move, find, you know, the best place you can in your first turn. I wouldn't recommend taking longer than that to find a capital spot.
Always had this phobia about moving at all, and certainly beyond, oh yes, I can move, and I can settle also this turn. Settling on top of a river was mentioned. Getting next to a mountain for Observatory or Machu Picchu, or to go, or get next to the ocean from FN Lizard 2. I can see about the ocean. As for the mountain, I mean, that also ties into a little bit to your defense. I mean, if you're right beside it, that's one particular hex that a sieve, if there's that early declaration of war, it's not going to be able to get to you on. I can certainly see the observatory argument for that, which is a little later on, but I certainly wouldn't be hinging on, I want to settle this because I want to be able to build this particular wonder. I think that's a little too precarious. Weasel slapper. Oh, my. And this is not, I'm not being mean to somebody or anything, or whoa to somebody.
That's an interesting name there, yeah.
I approve of this name, mind you.
He says, if this is going to be a production city, you're better settling off grassland if it's nearby for more production, less population. Science City, you'll be better off with the hill, more population on less production. Maybe as an early game consideration, maybe. I guess I'd never really viewed it in that terms and trying to get it down to a particular sentence. And, of course, they're just comparing, strictly speaking, grassland and hill. But you're also taking into account when you're settling the city, of course, not just the tile that you're settling on, but your potential radius. Then there was also discussions about, well, later on in the game, if you settle here, then you're in a better position to do this. And there was a bunch of math, and I had a fatal exception error in my head. But generally... as was pointed by Brutalist Maximus, okay, we're talking about the capital here, not a future specialist city. The Civ 5 snowballs, one extra production in the first 5 turn itself leads into hundreds later, which is very true. I did kind of like Blight Moon's comment, and this is a bit of a side plug for Modcast, which has returned. I found one mod very useful in making this decision much easier. Initial Settler Runner Shoes mod gives your first settler 4 moves.
Wow.
Okay, so short of using mods.
Well, I think a map hack would help too. And that's a little bit different from a mod, certainly. So if you know where your opponents are that way, you can settle towards them.
And of course, if you find yourself in a situation where you cannot move, i.e. you're in a one-tile island, well...
Better known restart. As a Dan Island.
Dan Island. Just restart.
Number 5 from episode 112.
I just not a leader game start person. I again, part of my contractual requirements is to make fun of people who like leader starts. You see, it's kind of like having, oh, but Dan, he's Canadian, but his status is friendly, yet... He just said this? Like, what's up with that? See? So I'm mimicking the behavior that we're talking about. Okay, anyway, maybe I'm overanalyzing this too much.
He's a rogue Canadian.
Oh, John, please don't report me to our intelligence agency.
Well, I don't know. I'll have to report you maybe to the language police or something instead then.
Oh, you're right. I got to be careful. A, what's this all about?
Yep. Fail.
What? I'm meeting language requirements of Canadians. I'm catching up here. I didn't say it enough. Okay, a boot. A. There, I'm caught up.
Number 4 from episode 116.
Yeah.
Wait, he was referring to Polyg? Never mind.
My little help from my friends. What? No, you said I was going to get yes.
No. If you want to climb over, you got to get with my friend.
Oh. Again.
Yes.
Sorry,
yes.
Maggie.
Singing epidemic.
You were too young for that song when it came out.
Thanks, Lisa. Now, since you sang too, you've authorized it.
No, that did not authorize it.
Yes.
well.
Which no. requires me to sing at some point, possibly.
Ugh. Come on, Mac, you just join in and you could sing a song about how bad the rest of us are at singing. Then everybody wins.
So what's our next topic?
So, I was going to make a nice segue about, you know, speaking of friends.
Oh, I thought it was going to be about Polycast the Musical.
Oh, well. I'm getting that. Polycast after the music. Behind the music.
Number 3 from episode 132.
Well, let's give people an incentive to actually do this other than our just saying so. If you do so and you inform us that you've tested this, Pixar doesn't count, then what you need to do is inform us, we'll mention your username on the show, and Lisa will send you a virtual kiss.
No!
But those virtual kisses.
You have I love how you're just like that. Giving them away without my consent, man. I charge a lot for these things.
Number 2 from episode 122.
So, I hear you guys like patches. Rex is going to put another patch in your Civ 5?
No. Yes, but no.
This will be a fun topic to discuss. This thing is quite lengthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hello, 3 or 4 pages of patch notes.
Well, you're saying you're not going to read them all to us?
Don't you have a top 10 list?
That's Dan's job.
Would you say that?
I think we should put a poll up.
Yes, absolutely.
You're just trying to bait Dan into it.
My line item with these polls and discuss their merits.
Have we have a thread that has a poll and a top 10 list in it? Oh my gosh.
Have you a poll about which top 10 list would be the best to use?
Oh.
Number 1 from episode 120. The tall versus wide debate in Civ has been best represented in the case of Civilization V.
John, did I hear this right, that you tend to run a small empire? Did I get that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, doesn't that also make, I mean, if you're saying you don't see the distinctions, or at least you don't feel the choices are quite as important with the national wonders, I mean, I think if you're running a smaller empire, that's very much the case. The nice thing about, I mean, the nature of a lot of these is bigger you get, the harder it is to pursue these different lines. Mm-hmm. But if you're running a small empire, the whole game is geared around narrow but deep. I think if you're running a smaller empire, this decision will naturally be easier because that's what enables small empires to flourish in civilization.
Yeah, priorities or you know, go in a niche kind of thing. That's what you mean, right? No?
No. I'm agreeing with you. I'm just saying a prayer that one day you will see the advantage to a wide empire over a tall empire. And smaller empire, faster turns. Yay! Negative. An empire is like small. Well, okay.
Well, okay. So I mean, power. Land is power, isn't it, then?
Yes, it is.
Hang on, because I'm sorry, I kind of want to get into this now, because I'm interested to see the clash of philosophies here, because Civilization V, for me, is the first civilization that really does reward not expanding. There are a lot of cool ways to win by, you know, operating a tiny, minuscule little empire. And this is one of my frustrations with Civ 5 is I feel like I have to really struggle to have the kind of world-spanning empire I've enjoyed in previous civilizations. So I'd be curious to hear you get into what are the advantages, Dan, because it might make for a more interesting game, perhaps a more demanding game, but advantages, I think, is a bit of a stretch. I've never felt like, you know, unless you can actually pull off the domination victory, I've never felt like having a far-flung empire has really rewarded me in the game.
You know, it's even more extensive. Okay, I'm going to start again. First off, I agree that if you're looking for a smaller empire, Civilization V is really helping you out as compared to most other, maybe even all other Civ titles. A big thing when it comes to domination for me in Civilization V as compared to Civilization IV is a page that Civilization V borrows from Civilization Revolution. And that comes in when in Civilization IV, if you wanted to win, that there's the domination and the conquest, and that domination you had to have such and such percentage of both the population and the land.
Yeah.
And the land was like, oh my word. Mm. Okay, 0.5% closer. I'm 0.25% closer. I'm 0.5% closer. Are you kidding me?
Just one more tile.
But in Civilization V, you take out all of your opponent's capitals, you win.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually Civilization V in that respect is helping towards domination. We got rid of this conquest domination distinction, and now it's just called domination.
Mm.
Whereas it also helps those looking for the smaller empires, those going for, well, culture victory, I still think is pretty darn difficult in Civ 5.
Yeah.
We're going to exclude a time victory because that's a cop-out. This editorial brought to you by. But as far as like a spaceship or a diplomacy win, absolutely. And I mean, sure, you can go for a cultural one too. I mean, you just have to bang your head maybe a little bit less against the wall in Civilization 5 as compared to some earlier Civ titles. And now everybody's thinking about banging their head against the wall and how much that would hurt. Or maybe they're thinking about, but if it was Dan's head.
How'd you read my mind, Dan?
That's because we're on the same wavelength, Mackie.
Get off my wavelength.
I'm not going to get off of our wavelength.
It's mine. Okay, I was here first.
But just to interject here, I still don't feel you've made the case for running a large empire. Because what you describe here, you're basically taking out hits on enemy capitals. That's totally different than having a huge empire. That's a different kettle of fish.
Well, I mean, as far as towards dominant, I'm talking victories specifically. Now, as far as managing a particularly large empire, when you're taking cities. The fact, for instance, that I can leave them as puppets, for example. Sure, I don't have to emphasize particular control over those cities, and I don't get to choose what they're doing, but they manage economy very well. I've been finding that if I go into a city, for instance, if I'm capturing those cities and they stay my puppets, they can become my economic powerhouse. If I go in and start changing those cities, particularly those that are going to be puppets on a river where I've got a trading post bonus already, like there's already inherent gold production, and then whatever technology down in the tree increases trading post output by plus one, it's about mid-game. I'm sure Imagine can help out with that in the chat what that technology is.
It's a social policy, not a tech.
I was sure that there was also a technology that increased the trade.
Oh, that's... I think there is, but it's so down the hill that I simply don't remember.
Okay, but in any event, that those cities that I'm taking over can become my economic base. And so now that I have that many more cities, and we know how strong economy is in Civ 5 and being able to buy what it is between buildings and units and maybe even also influencing some city-states, right? Mm-hmm. Because if I'm thinking, oh, I'm really hurting myself as far as culture by really building this white empire, I'm building more cities, I'm not able, cultural costs, the number of turns it's going to take to is increasing, and yes, I know that there are some wonders that I could build to combat that, just like anything. But let's say I'm not doing that. I'm just expanding. I'm taking over land. At a certain point, because I know I only have to now take out the capital in order to win the game, quote-unquote officially win the game, because I think if you just take a capital and you continue to play afterwards, that could be like a different circumstance if you really want to continue wiping them out. But I've gotten in situations where at some point, because of that large empire, that large economic base, I was able to, even though it was really farther down along the technology tree, it took me a little longer. There was nothing like being able to take six turns by myself, a giant death robot, take it across the water with a naval escort, and it just so also happened that their capital happened to be on the coast.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'll be taking your capital now.
And I'm not saying that a small empire can't win. I'm saying that when it comes to a very large empire, Civ 5 is even more attractive than Civilization 4.
Yeah, I agree, actually. But that's kind of one of my beefs with Civ 5 is that it's really, as it was originally when it came out, it was just ridiculous to run a 12 empire at all. And I prefer that because I like to develop kind of the flavor of my empire to focus on a certain thing, either, you know, go all production to have, or more, just tech or trade or money and stuff like that. And the social policies in Civ 5, I like them. I think they're really cool for that. But I think they come too rarely, in any game, unless you're actually going for the kind of cultural thing. And still then, it takes forever to get them. And they're the only real decisions I feel I'm making in the game. So, I mean, I might just be playing it wrong. I should be going around killing people and, but I always felt that Civ was more of a builder game than a war game. And I don't feel that the building part of it is adequately handled for me to kind of, you know, enjoy it as much as I'd like.
I think you're playing Civ wrong. Anybody who says you're playing Civ wrong, you're doing this wrong. It depends on maybe you're doing it wrong or not as well for what it is that you want to do. I'm definitely not going to be one of those that says, oh, you really should be going for this type of victory condition, but, you know. And Imagine is right that a lot of the advantages I've been talking about have been about domination versus expansion. He points out about, you know, generating great people, expand, you know, and build one per city. When you're expanding and you're taking that land yourself, either because you're building new cities or you're also taking over other cities.
Yep.
It's either you're taking over that city, maybe you do want to annex that particular city you take over because it is such a production powerhouse and you want that direct control. Or this is going to be a real economic-focused city, I'm going to take that and let it stay a puppet and change over its improvements so it actually increases the economy to help boost that, to be able to have more, even more cities and more units and a bigger empire. And you can also get the choice in with the larger empire. You can also choose to raise cities, even if it's, I don't make use of this, but they could make use of it, but I want to deny them that. And their also ability to do what they want to do, be it a cultural victory or a diplomatic victory, is lessened. I'm not saying they're not going to be able to do it, but it's just going to take them more time to be able to do that. If I am running amok and I am able to, you know, back my words with X weapons, it doesn't have to be nuclear weapons, that I have sufficient firepower, then that's the strength of an expansion and domination focus over others. And I'm not saying the others aren't viable. They are. The others can be enjoyable. And I have tried other victory conditions. Sometimes what you think you're going to be doing, oh crap, you do need to be adaptable. But I find that if at the very least, I think we can all agree that at the very least, even if you're not going for an expansion, a domination victory, you need to be able to defend yourself. Now, that does not simply mean that you need to have the units to do so yourself. Either you're going with AIs to help protect you, formal AIs to help protect you, I think you're better off to be befriending some militaristic city-states actually to be gifting you some.
Yeah. But the thing is, I consider building a flat empire as one possible strategy. I would like for it to be kind of one alternative, and the other alternatives would be choosing a small empire but focusing on, for example, science or, for example, trade or, for example, tech to a larger extent. Now it's a bit more, it's all kind of, to me, it feels a bit bland. A lot of running a tall empire is, well, you'll end up building everything in most cities. You focus a little here and a little there, but I don't know. I'm just building a huge empire. I mean, it's just fighting and fighting and fighting. And I'm sure that's all right, but I really get bored with it, especially since the AI is about as threatening as an imbecile with, a fork.
and number one from episode 126.
We here at the podcast do accept donations to make this a better podcast.
Yeah, you managed to say that full sentence before you started to laugh, Alex. Well done on a first go-to, man. Good job.
It's a 1,000% pay raise right there. 1,000%.
1,000 times zero is still... Wait, what?
Yeah.
Oh, but wait. You know, Anna Lee pointed this out a few episodes ago about multiplying by zero. Like, why are you pointing this stuff out? Is this like a conspiracy with you two to point these things out?
It's not conspiracy if you're married.
Just don't divide by zero.
Dividing by zero is the secret to being good at Civ games, actually. I don't think we should out that just yet.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for listening to Polycast Evergreen, Season 5. I'm Wouter Locutus Snyders. I only wish to raise the quality of life for all gamers.
Civilization 1 Clips, copyright Microprose.
Civilization 4 Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.